This is tape one, side one. The Baha'i Faith by Mary Perkins and Philip Hainsworth. This tape has been made by the Baha'i Service for the Blind, 1989. Your reader is Bill Peary. This tape has been tone indexed. A single tone is given for each page number. A double tone is given for each chapter section. Table of Contents. Introduction, page 5. Acknowledgements, page 6. Chapter 1, How the Baha'i Faith Began, page 7. Subheadings. The Land of Iran, page 7. The Search for the Promised One, page 7. The Declaration of the Bab, page 11. The Ministry of the Bab, page 16. The Execution of the Bab, page 18. The Bab and His Message, page 19. Baha'u'llah, page 20. Exile in Iraq, page 23. Exile in Turkey, page 26. Banishment to the Holy Land, page 28. Abdu'l-Bahá, page 33. Abdu'l-Bahá's Unique Position, page 36. Growth of the Baha'i Faith during the lifetime of its three central figures, page 37. A Tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 38. Chapter 2, What Baha'is Believe, page 39. Subheadings, The Oneness of Humanity, page 39. The Oneness of Religion, page 40. Elimination of Prejudice, page 42. Harmony of Religion and Science, page 43. Independent Investigation into Truth, page 45. The Nature of God, page 45. The Nature of Man, page 47. The Soul of Man, Life and Death, page 47. Evolution, page 50. Good and Evil, page 50. How an Individual Should Live, page 51. The Family, page 53. Equality of Men and Women, page 57. Universal Compulsory Education, page 59. Unfolding of World Civilization, page 59. Prohibitions, page 61. Chapter 3, How the Baha'is Live, page 62. Introduction, page 62. A New World Order, page 65. The Baha'i Fund, page 84. Baha'i Houses of Worship, page 86. The Baha'i Calendar, page 89. Relations with the Non-Baha'i World, page 90. The bibliography and index have been omitted from this reading. The reader should also note that not all footnotes and references have been given. The spelling of the names of the central figures of the Baha'i Faith. The Bab. B-A-B. Baha'u'llah. B-A-H-A apostrophe U apostrophe L-L-A-H. Abdu'l-Bahá. A-B-D-U apostrophe L hyphen capital B-A-H-A. Baha'i is spelled B-A H-A apostrophe I. Page 5, Introduction. The Baha'i Faith is the religion of the followers of Baha'u'llah. The name Baha'u'llah is Arabic for the glory of God, and a Baha'i is a follower of Baha'u'llah. The Baha'i Faith is the youngest of the world's living religions. It began in Iran in 1844 and is now, in 1979, established in over 102,000 centers scattered through 343 countries, dependent territories, and major island groups. Baha'i literature has been translated into more than 670 different languages. Although it began in a Muslim country, Iran, the Baha'i faith is as distinct from Islam as Christianity is from Judaism. And it is a world religion which has spread to almost every corner of the globe within its first 130 years. It includes within its membership a cross-section of the human race and offers to the whole of mankind a way to peace, love, and unity which is satisfying, challenging, and inspiring. The Baha'i International Community is an international non-governmental organization cooperating closely with the United Nations to achieve the goals of world peace, universal human rights, and the full economic and social development of the peoples of this planet. It was granted consultative status with the Economic and Social Council in 1970 and has permanent representatives at the United Nations headquarters in New York and in Geneva, and with the United Nations Environment Program in Nairobi. The human race, so rich in its diversity of color, culture, tradition, and experience, must, if it is to be united in carrying forward an ever-advancing world civilization, be offered a new way of life, simple in its basic features, but sufficiently complex in its detailed application to cater for all its needs and aspirations. The Baha'i Faith offers this new way of life. This book serves as an introduction to the faith. It does not in any way attempt to deal with all the many aspects of this new world faith, but it is a fairly comprehensive textbook written to give enough of its history, teachings, and objectives to encourage further study. It will be a study, we believe, which will be highly rewarding and not a little exciting. Mary Perkins and Philip Hainsworth. Page 6. Acknowledgements. The authors and publishers would like to thank the following for their help in supplying the photographs which illustrate this book: the Baha'i World Center, Ted Carbell, Adam Thorne, Hari Dotri, and many other kind friends, and Mr. George Ronald, publisher, for permission to use the map of Persia, Rostam Sabat and Lois Hainsworth, for their invaluable help and suggestions when checking the manuscript for accuracy. We also express gratitude to the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of the United Kingdom, whose reviewing panel gave the manuscript their approval. Page 7. How the Baha'i Faith Began. The Land of Iran. Iran consists of a large plateau, surrounded on all sides by high mountains, with a great salt desert at its center. To the west is the plain of the Tigris, to the east the Indus Valley, to the north the Caspian Sea and the Turanian Desert, and to the south the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean. In order to appreciate the environment into which the Baha'i Faith was born, it is important to realize that in the early 1800s, the whole area of the Middle East was in a state of political, economic, and social decline. The people of Iran, who in previous centuries had produced great civilizations, were by 1800 weakened and isolated from the main currents of world affairs. A few people lived in great luxury, while many suffered through poverty, disease, and ignorance. Attempts at reform were hindered by widespread corruption, bribery, and malpractice on the part of the government. Most of the people of Iran were Muslim, but there were also people of the Zoroastrian, Jewish, and Christian faiths living in the country. There was much mutual hatred and intolerance between the followers of these different faiths. Yet Iran, or Persia as it was known, was of great significance to both Muslims and Christians, having been mentioned in a number of places in their scriptures. The Reverend H. Bonar, a Christian scholar writing on biblical prophecy in the early part of the 19th century, accepted the prophecies about Assyria, Elam, and Persia, but confessed to being unable to explain why these places should, in the latter days, be so blessed. The Search for the Promised One. In the late 18th century, a learned and saintly Muslim called Sheikh Ahmad set out on a journey from his home on an island in the Persian Gulf. He was prompted to travel by his conviction that the Promised One, mentioned in the Islamic scriptures, would shortly appear on earth. Sheikh Ahmad believed that this holy messenger of God, whose coming was prophesied, was a great world teacher expected by all the peoples of the world. Page 10. His appearance on earth, Sheikh Ahmad believed, would mark the beginning of a new age for humanity, an age when the different religions would become united and all men live in peace. Sheikh Ahmad traveled first to Najaf and then to Karbala, a city holy to the Muslims. The Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, had been martyred at Karbala. In Karbala, Sheikh Ahmad began to preach and teach, but later moved into Iran. A young man named Syed Kazim, Syed is a title meaning that the person is a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, heard of Sheikh Ahmad's teachings and traveled across the country to meet him. Sheikh Ahmad greeted the young man joyfully. He knew that he had found someone with whom he could share all his knowledge and the longings of his heart. Together they studied and prayed, traveled and taught. Sheikh Ahmad appointed Syed Kazim as his successor, and after his teacher's death, Syed Kazim remained at Kabila and continued to teach there. One of those who came to learn from the Syed was a young man called Mullah Hussein. Mullah Hussein was a pure-hearted and eager seeker after truth and a brilliant scholar. Syed Kazim knew that he could trust Mullah Hussein completely. He had great confidence in the young student's abilities and sent him on a special mission to Iran. In due course, Syed Kazim became increasingly aware of the imminence of the dawn of a new revelation and endeavored to lift the veil that might prevent his disciples from recognizing God's treasure when he was revealed. He told them, "He is of noble lineage, a descendant of the Prophet of God. He is young in age and possessed of innate knowledge. His learning is derived not from the teachings of Sheikh Ahmad, but from God. My knowledge is but a drop compared with the immensity of his knowledge, my attainments a speck of dust in the face of the wonders of his grace and power. He is of medium height, abstains from smoking, and is of extreme devoutness and piety." Syed Kazim urged his followers to scatter far and wide to look for the Promised One, to give up their careers, their belongings, even if necessary, their lives in their search. Mullah Hussein returned from Iran to find that his teacher had died. Page 11. He spent 40 days in prayer and fasting, preparing his heart for the journey of search. Some of his fellow students, inspired by his example, began to do the same. When the 40 days were over, Mullah Hussein set out on his journey with two young companions, his brother and his nephew, who were both barely 20 years old. The three young men left Kabila with no clear idea of where they should first look. They prayed earnestly for guidance from God, and Mullah Hussein found himself being drawn, as if by a magnet, towards Shiraz, a city in the south of Iran. Shiraz is a beautiful city, famous for its poets, its flower gardens, and nightingales. Mullah Hussein and his companions arrived at the city gate late one afternoon. They were dusty, hungry, and tired. Mullah Hussein sent his companions on ahead into the city and lingered for a while outside the city gate, wondering what he would find in Shiraz that might lead him to the Promised One. As he stood outside the city gate, a young man with a radiant face and wearing a green turban, an indication that he was descended from the Prophet Muhammad, approached him. The young stranger smiled and welcomed Mullah Hussein to Shiraz as if he were a long-lost friend. His radiance and serenity, his purity, courtesy, and dignity made a strong impression on the travel-weary Mullah Hussein, who was filled with joy in the stranger's company. The young stranger invited Mullah Hussein to enter the city and refresh himself at his house. Mullah Hussein explained that he had sent his companions on ahead and that they would be waiting for him. "Commit them to the care of God. He will surely protect and watch over them," said the young stranger, and he escorted Mullah Hussein into the city of Shiraz. The Declaration of the Bab. The young man who met Mullah Hussein outside Shiraz was named Syed Ali Muhammad. He was descended through both of his parents from the Prophet Muhammad. He was born on October 20, 1819. His father had died when he was young, and he had been brought up by an uncle. When his uncle first sent his nephew to school, the teacher sent him home again, saying that there was nothing that he could teach the boy that he did not already know. Ali Muhammad had an extraordinary innate knowledge that he had not learned from books or from any other person. This innate knowledge enabled him to answer the most difficult questions which his teachers could not themselves answer. Page 13. In his early teens, Ali Muhammad began to work for his uncle as a merchant at the port of Bushehr and in Shiraz. He was soon respected for his modesty and fair-mindedness in business, for his devotion and humility, for the depth and breadth of his knowledge, and for the sweetness and nobility of his character. At the time that he met Mulu Hussein, he had been working for fewer than 10 years. He had married his mother's cousin, and his baby son had died when he was 1 year old. This was the young merchant who met Mulu Hussein and then led him courteously to his home, a modest house in a quiet corner of Shiraz. Mulu Hussein felt a growing sense of peace and happiness in the company of his host. It was time for the evening prayers observed by all Muslims. The two young men knelt in prayer, and Mulu Hussein prayed earnestly that this strange encounter might somehow help him in his search for the Promised One. When they had said their prayers, they sat and spoke together. Overwhelmed by the great kindness, dignity, and courtesy of his host, Mulu Hussein unburdened the deepest longings of his heart. He spoke of the journey and search that he had undertaken. Ali Muhammad listened attentively and then asked whether Sayyid Kazim had given any indications as to how his followers would recognize the Promised One. Mulu Hussein repeated the description given by Sayyid Kazim. He is of a pure lineage, is of illustrious descent. He is endowed with innate knowledge, is free from bodily deficiency. There was silence in the room for a few moments when Mulu Hussein finished speaking. Then Sayyid Ali Muhammad spoke quietly, but in tones of strength and power. Behold, all these signs are manifest in me. Mulu Hussein was greatly surprised. He began to protest, saying that the Promised One he sought was a man of unsurpassed holiness, and the cause he was to reveal was a cause of tremendous power. But even as he spoke, he experienced a sense of awe and remorse. He ceased to protest. He eagerly took out a paper which he had written some years earlier. It was an attempt he had made to explain some of the most difficult teachings of Sheikh Ahmad and Sayyid Kazim. He asked his host to look at the paper. The Sayyid read it rapidly and explained, simply and clearly, all the difficulties that Mulu Hussein had encountered in writing the paper. He then said, as Mulu Hussein listened with astonishment and joy, "Now is the time to reveal the commentary on the Surah of Joseph." Page 14. The Surah of Joseph, Surah means chapter, is a chapter in the Quran. Mulu Hussein had once asked Sayyid Kazim to write a commentary on that chapter. "This is verily beyond me," Sayyid Kazim had replied. "He, that great one who comes after me, will, unasked, reveal it for you." As Mulu Hussein recalled these words spoken by his teacher, his host took up his pen and began to write. He chanted the words in a melodious voice as he wrote them down. He did not pause in his chanting or his writing until a whole chapter, the Surah of Mulk, was completed. Mulu Hussein sat listening, enraptured by the sweetness of his voice and the power of the words he uttered. The declaration that he was indeed the Promised One was made by the young merchant of Shiraz to Mulu Hussein 2 hours and 11 minutes after sunset on 22nd May 1844. It is a date and time that is celebrated by Baha'is as the beginning of a new era in human history. "O thou who art the first to believe in me," were the exact words he spoke to Mulu Hussein. "Verily I say I am the Bab, the gate of God." The Bab means the gate, and the Bab claimed to be the gate to a new age of peace and universal brotherhood. He said that his mission was to foretell the coming of another, much greater messenger, who would shortly appear. He referred to this great messenger as he whom God shall make manifest, and spoke of him as one who would unite all men and establish a just and lasting peace on earth. All through that night, Mulu Hussein sat and listened, oblivious of time and of the companions who awaited him, as the Bab continued. While the city slept around them, the Bab warned Mulu Hussein that he must tell no one, not even his companions, of what he had seen and heard. 18 souls must, said the Bab, in the beginning, spontaneously and of their own accord, accept me and recognize the truth of my revelation. Unwarned and uninvited, each of these must seek independently to find me. As the call to morning prayer was raised from the minarets of Shiraz, Mulu Hussein left the house of the Bab. Joy, wonder, excitement, and awe filled his soul. "The knowledge of his revelation," he said, "had galvanized my being. I felt possessed of such courage and power that were the world, all its peoples and potentates, to rise against me, I would alone and undaunted withstand their onslaught. Page 15. The universe seemed but a handful of dust in my grasp. 40 more days passed before the other disciples of the Bab began to recognize him. Gradually, spontaneously, and completely independently of one another, some in fasting and prayer, some in dreams and visions, they recognized the station of the young merchant of Shiraz. They had all been students of Syed Kazim, and seemed to be attracted to Shiraz by the same power that had drawn Mullah Hussein to the city. The last to arrive was Quduz. He reached Shiraz, dust-stained and travel-weary. On seeing Mullah Hussein in the street, he eagerly asked for news of the search. Mullah Hussein tried to pacify him, but without success, for Quduz had seen the Bab walking in the street. "Why seek you to hide him from me?" Quduz cried out to the astonished Mullah Hussein. "I can recognize him by his gait. I confidently testify that none besides him, whether in the east or in the west, can claim to be the truth. None other can manifest the power and majesty that radiate from his holy person." The Bab called together those disciples who had reached Shiraz and told them to scatter through Iran to spread his teachings and to prepare men's hearts for the coming of him whom God shall make manifest. He stressed the great responsibility that they carried, urged caution and moderation, and warned that they would face torture and death as a reward for their efforts. "I am preparing you," he told them, "for the advent of a mighty day. Exert your utmost endeavor that in the world to come, I who am now instructing you may, before the mercy seat of God, rejoice in your deeds and glory in your achievements. Scatter throughout the length and breadth of this land, and with steadfast feet and unsanctified hearts, prepare the way for his coming. Heed not your weaknesses and frailty. Fix your gaze upon the invincible power of the Lord your God and the Almighty. Has he not in past days caused Abraham, in spite of his seeming helplessness, to triumph over the forces of Nimrod? Has he not enabled Moses, whose staff was his only companion, to vanquish Pharaoh and his hosts? Has he not established the ascendancy of Jesus, poor and lowly as he was in the eyes of men, over the combined forces of the Jewish people? Has he not subjected the barbarous and militant tribes of Arabia to the holy and transforming discipline of Muhammad, his prophet? Arise in his name, put your trust wholly in him, and be assured of ultimate victory." Verse 16. The Ministry of the Bab. The followers of the Bab set out joyfully to spread his teachings. The message that they gave sparked off a tremendous excitement in Iran. People thronged to hear them, and the fame of the Bab grew swiftly. Rich and poor, simple and learned, town dweller and villager alike wanted to know more. A number of learned and highly respected religious teachers became followers of the Bab. The authorities became alarmed and reacted swiftly. When Quduz and an elderly companion began to spread the Bab's teachings in Shiraz, they were seized by the authorities of that city. Their beards were burned, their noses pierced. Through this incision, a cord was passed, and with this halter they were led through the streets. They were beaten and sent out of Shiraz with a warning that if they tried to return, they would be crucified. The Bab was put under house arrest as a wave of passionate inquiry rocked the country. The Shah sent Vahid, a most trusted advisor and a learned and influential and highly respected man, to investigate the cause of the excitement. Vahid became a devoted follower of the Bab after three interviews with him, and at once began to spread his teachings. The Grand Vizier, the chief minister of the Shah, became extremely worried. He was frightened that the Bab might influence the Shah if they should meet. He therefore imprisoned the Bab at Maku in the north of the country. The people living around Maku were simple farmers, ignorant of the world beyond their own hills and hostile to outsiders. The prison governor was at first hostile to the Bab, but soon realized that he was no ordinary person. He began to love and revere the Bab. The local farmers felt the influence of the prisoner in their lives. They came to stand beneath the prison walls in the hope of hearing him chant his prayers. They asked for his blessings on their daily work and carried and called on each other to speak the truth in his name. The visitors came from far and wide, The governor allowed them in and became daily more devoted to the prisoner in his charge. Again, the Grand Vizier became alarmed and sent the Bab to a more remote prison at Shikrik. The governor of Shikrik prison was the Shah's own brother-in-law. He was harsh and unpredictable, and at the outset acted with great severity, but he too yielded to the fascination of the Bab. Again, the local people began to love and revere him. Again, the visitors streamed to Shikrik. One visitor was a man from India who reached Shikrik dressed as a hermit. He had been a prince in his own country, but had seen the Bab in a vision and had given up wealth and position to look for him. Page 17. The Bab sent him back to India to spread the teachings. Persecution of the Bab's followers increased as the teachings spread in Iran. The Bab's first disciples and hundreds of those who had responded to their message were cruelly tortured and killed. Had they recanted their faith, they would have lived. The Bab's own uncle, who had reared and educated him, was killed because of his belief in the mission of his nephew. The Bab was filled with anguish and sorrow at the deaths of his followers. While in prison at Shikrik, he wrote down a great many of his teachings. He knew that his own death would soon come. In 1850, unable to stop the spread of the movement, the authorities decided to execute the Bab in an attempt to stamp out the heresy once and for all. Thus, after 3 years of relative freedom and free of activity, the Bab's six-year ministry was hastening to its spectacular climax. Page 18. The execution of the Bab. The Bab was taken to Tabriz. As he was led into the city, a young man threw himself at the Bab's feet and begged to be allowed to die with him. The young man was arrested and condemned to die with the Bab. On his last night on earth, the Bab was radiant and joyful. He knew that his mission was accomplished despite all opposition. Early next morning, the Bab was interrupted as he was dictating last-minute instructions to a companion. Soldiers sent from those responsible for the Bab's imprisonment attempted to hurry the Bab away, but he spoke to the official in charge, saying, "Not until I have said to him all those things I wish to say can any earthly power silence me. Though all the world be armed against me, yet shall they be powerless to deter me from fulfilling to the last word my intention." In a sequence of events remarkably similar to those experienced over 18 centuries earlier, when Jesus received his sentence without fair trial, the Bab was taken to the homes of the three eminent religious leaders to obtain the necessary death warrants. Not one of them condescended to face the Bab, as the documents were already written, signed, and sealed. The Bab was led through the crowded streets, where about 10,000 people had thronged to Tabriz to watch him die. Page 19. The leader of the regiment ordered to execute the Bab was a Christian named Sam Khan. He was impressed by the goodness and humility of the Bab and was deeply troubled by the task ahead of him. "I entertain no ill will against you," he told the Bab. "If your cause be the cause of truth, enable me to free myself from the obligation to shed your blood." "Follow your instructions," the Bab replied, "and if your intention be sincere, the Almighty is surely able to relieve you from your perplexity." The Bab and his young companion were suspended by ropes against the wall of the barrack square, and 750 soldiers of Sam Khan's regiment took aim at them and fired. When the smoke from the fire cleared, a great shout went up from the crowd. The Bab was nowhere to be seen, and the young man who had been tied up with him was standing unharmed. There was a frantic search for the Bab. They found him, finishing his instructions which had earlier been interrupted. "I have finished my conversation," the Bab told those who found him. "Now you may proceed to fulfill your intention." Sam Khan ordered his own regiment out of the barracks and refused to have anything more to do with the execution of the Bab. Another regiment was called in. This time, the bodies of the Bab and his companions were shattered to pieces, though their faces were hardly marred. The execution took place at noon on 9 July 1850. At the same hour, a fierce storm broke over the city. Strong winds blew and dust darkened the skies for the rest of the day. The bodies of the Bab and his companions were thrown outside the city walls, and 40 soldiers were set on guard so that the followers of the Bab should not rescue them. Despite this guard, the Bab's followers managed to rescue the remains of the bodies and hide them in a place of safety. The Bab and his message. The Bab claimed to be the bearer of an independent revelation from God and the herald of a greater messenger than himself. He changed the Islamic laws and ceremonies concerned with prayer, fasting, marriage, divorce, and inheritance. In his writings, his constant theme is the coming of him whom God shall make manifest. He extols the greatness of the messenger who is to come, and urges his followers to hurry to him when he appears, even if they have to crawl to him over snow. Page 20. I myself am, the Bab wrote, but the first servant to believe in him and in his signs, and to partake of the sweet savors of his words from the first fruits of the paradise of his knowledge. The Bab believed that God's next messenger would appear very shortly after his own death. 2 years after the Bab was shot, two of his young followers, crazed with grief and despair at the death of their leader, attempted to assassinate the Shah. The weapon they chose was quite unsuitable for their purpose, and the Shah was only slightly wounded. Their act triggered off a wave of persecution against the Babis. The authorities whipped up popular support for a campaign of vengeance and determined to rid themselves of the Babis. Men, women, and children were tortured and killed in ghastly massacres. Foreign residents in Iran kept to their houses for fear of witnessing savage scenes of torture and killing in the streets, and the most able and distinguished of the Bab's followers, a man named Baha'u'llah, was thrown into prison. Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah means in Arabic, the glory of God, and was a name mentioned by the Bab. Baha'u'llah was born, Mirza Hussein Ali, into one of the leading noble families of Iran. His father was a leading minister at the court of the Shah. He was born in Tehran on November 12, 1817. Baha'u'llah was surrounded from birth by riches, comfort, and elegance. His clothes were of the finest silk, his food the best that wealth and position could provide. His family owned fine houses. In common with his young noble contemporaries, Baha'u'llah received instruction in the main teachings of Islam, the literature and poetry of Iran, and was taught calligraphy. Baha'u'llah, like the Bab, possessed an extraordinary knowledge that was not gained from a teacher or from any books. Men marveled at the breadth and depth of his knowledge and at his exceptional powers of logic and reasoning. At the age of 7, he represented his father in a property dispute at the court of the Shah and won the case for which he argued. His exceptional knowledge did not make him proud. He was modest and genial, sympathetic, and very kind. His tastes were simple. He loved the countryside, birds, trees, flowers, and animals, and preferred to spend his time in the country rather than at court. Page 21. He did not spend his money on personal luxuries, but on helping the poor and needy. He married young, as was the custom at the time. His wife was from a very wealthy family, but her tastes were similar to her husband's. Together they worked to help those less fortunate than themselves. Their doors were always open to those in need of food, shelter, and help. They were given the names, the father and mother of the poor. When Baha'u'llah's father died, his position at court was offered to his son, but Baha'u'llah refused to accept it. In the summer of 1844, just 3 months after the Bab declared his mission, Mulu Hussein carried to Tehran a scroll of the Bab's writing and saw that it reached the hands of Baha'u'llah. On reading the scroll, Baha'u'llah immediately recognized the claims of the Bab and became his follower at the age of 27. Baha'u'llah never met the Bab, but was in constant correspondence with him, and he gave a wholehearted support to the spread of the Bab's teachings. In so doing, he put himself on the side of a little-known movement which was directly opposed to the privileges of his own class. While the Bab was in prison, Baha'u'llah lent every possible assistance to his persecuted followers. He was twice imprisoned and once deliberately drew the anger of a mob upon himself rather than allow his companions to suffer. He was beaten and pelted with stones. Undaunted and with tireless energy, Baha'u'llah supported, advised, and assisted the persecuted Babis. When the Bab knew that he would soon die, he sent to Baha'u'llah his pens, seals, and papers. It was at Baha'u'llah's initiative and on his explicit instructions that the remains of the Bab were removed from Tabriz to Tehran and hidden in a place of safety. In the days following the attempt on the Shah's life, Baha'u'llah was a guest of the Grand Vizier. His friends begged him to hide until the tumult was over, but Baha'u'llah refused to do this. Instead, he rode towards the army camp where his own seizure and arrest were being planned. Baha'u'llah was stripped of his outer garments and was put in chains. He was made to walk bareheaded and barefooted under the midday sun to prison in Tehran. A large crowd had gathered to hurl stones and insults at him. Baha'u'llah asked his guards to slow down in order to enable an old woman who wanted to throw a stone to catch up with the procession. "Suffer not this woman," he said, "to be disappointed. Deny her not what she regards as a meritorious act in the sight of God." The prison to which Baha'u'llah was taken had originally been a reservoir for one of the public baths of the city. Page 22. He was led down a pitch-black corridor and down three flights of steps. The prison chamber was dark, damp, and verminous. 150 fever-ridden men were kept there with scarcely any clothes and no bedding. They were, for the most part, murderers, highwaymen, and robbers. Baha'u'llah and a number of other Babis were chained among them. Baha'u'llah was placed in stocks, and heavy chains were secured over his shoulders so that he could neither stand up nor lie down. The heavy chains cut into his flesh, and he bore the marks of them for the rest of his life. For 3 days they were given no food or drink, and when food did reach Baha'u'llah, his enemies had poisoned it. The authorities did not dare to execute Baha'u'llah, as he was held in such high esteem. Each day the guards came to fetch out one of the Babis to face torture and death. Each time a Babi was sent to death from that prison, he came first to ask for Baha'u'llah's blessings before hurrying joyfully to die. Baha'u'llah comforted and encouraged all the prisoners. He taught the Babis to chant prayers as they sat in their chains. First one row would sing, "God is sufficient unto me, he verily is the all-sufficing." And the other row would reply, "In him let the trusting trust." The prisoners sang with such joy and so loudly that the sound of their chanting could be heard by the Shah in his nearby palace. Baha'u'llah was kept in the prison under the same conditions for 4 months. He became very ill, his neck was galled, his back was bent, and he could scarcely walk. While in that prison, Baha'u'llah had a mystical experience which taught him that he himself was the one whom God shall make manifest, the Holy One whose coming the Bab had foretold. "During the days I lay in the prison of Tehran, though the galling weight of the chains and the stench-filled air allowed me but little sleep, still in those infrequent moments of slumber I felt as if something flowed from the crown of my head over my breast, even as a mighty torrent that precipitateth itself upon the earth from the summit of a lofty mountain. Every limb of my body would, as a result, be set afire. At such moments, my tongue recited what no man could bear to hear." Page 23. "O King, I was but a man like others, asleep upon my couch, when, lo, the breezes of the All-Glorious were wafted over me, and taught me the knowledge of all that hath been. This thing is not from me, but from one who is almighty and all-knowing. And he bade me lift up my voice between earth and heaven, and for this there befell me what hath caused the tears of every man of understanding to flow. His all-compelling summons hath reached me, and caused me to speak his praise amidst all people." Later in life, Baha'u'llah wrote of this experience in a letter to the Shah. Those who had ordered his imprisonment could not find one shred of evidence to prove that Baha'u'llah had been an accomplice in the attack on the Shah. The Russian minister to the Shah's court exerted his influence to get Baha'u'llah released from prison, offering him asylum in Russia. Reluctantly, the Shah gave his consent for Baha'u'llah's release. Thus, in December 1852, The 4 months' confinement in the abominable pit known as the Sea of Chal came to an end. It was in this subterranean dungeon, however, that Baha'u'llah, wrapped in its Stygian gloom, breathing its fetid air, numbed by its humid and icy atmosphere, his feet in stocks, had witnessed the real birth of the Baha'i Revelation. Baha'u'llah was stripped of his wealth and possessions, and preferring the edict of banishment imposed by his government to asylum in Russia, was given 1 month in which to remove himself and his family from the country. As his property had been confiscated, Baha'u'llah was not able to make adequate provision for the journey. It was midwinter and very cold, and his wife Nawab was 7 months pregnant. Baha'u'llah was ill, and the journey to Baghdad took 3 months. The exiles traveled over snow-covered mountains along rough mule tracks. The nights were spent in primitive shelters without adequate food or bedding, and Baha'u'llah's wife sold the silver buttons from her few dresses in order to buy flour to feed the children. Exile in Iraq. Baha'u'llah arrived in Baghdad, Iraq, on 8 April 1853, frail and ill. It had not been thought likely that he would survive the rigors of the journey or live long after it. He did, however, recover his strength and spent 10 years in Iraq. His influence was soon felt in the dispirited, confused, and leaderless followers of the Bab he found there. Page 24. At this, his own brother grew jealous of him, so without a word of warning to anyone, Baha'u'llah left the city one night, determined to stay away in order to avoid being a source of conflict and dissension among the Babis. It was only 1 year after his arrival in Baghdad. Baha'u'llah spent the next 2 years living alone as a hermit in the mountains of Kurdistan. The people of Kurdistan were a proud and warlike people, renowned for their hostility to the Persians. Though living in isolation, Baha'u'llah soon gained a reputation for his great kindness and wisdom. Learned men of the region sought him out. He was loved and respected by learned and illiterate alike, and gradually the fame of the wise and holy man living in the mountains reached Baghdad. Once his family heard of the wise hermit in Kurdistan, they knew that it was Baha'u'llah, and sent a messenger to beg him to return, which he did exactly 2 years after his departure, 19 March 1856. In Baha'u'llah's absence, the condition of the Babi community had gone from bad to worse. He spent the next 7 years educating and training the Babis in the basic teachings of the Bab. By precept and example, by his written and spoken words, he effected a transformation in the Babi community and proved himself the only person capable of ensuring the stability and integrity of the movement. The Babis became known in the city for the integrity of their character, the purity of their motives, and the excellence of their conduct. Baha'u'llah and his companions lived simply and austerely. They had very few material possessions, but they lived in great joy. The Kurdish mystics and the other religious teachers who had visited Baha'u'llah in the mountains now came to Baghdad to find him. Some of the local religious leaders also became curious and sought him out. Many became his followers. Poets, mystics, government officials, and princes sought his company. Those who were sick and suffering came to him. Those who sought justice thronged to his door. The great number of visitors and pilgrims included Christians and Jews as well as Muslims.
This is the end of side one. Please stop the tape at this point and turn to side two for continuation.